The Autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley.
When my mother was pregnant with me, she told me later, a party of hooded Ku Klux Klan riders galloped up to our home in Omaha, Nebraska one night. Surrounding the house, brandishing their shotguns and rifles, they shouted for my father to come out. My mother went to the front door and opened it. Standing where they could see her pregnant condition, she told them that she was alone with three small children and that my father was away preaching in Milwaukee. The Klansmen shouted threats and warnings at her that we had better get out of town because the good Christian white people were not going to stand for my father spreading trouble among the good Negroes of Omaha with the back to Africa preachings of Marcus Garvey. My father, the Reverend Earl Little, was a Baptist minister, a dedicated organizer for Marcus Aurelius Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. With the help of such disciples as my father, Garvey, from his headquarters in New York City's Harlem, was raising the banner of black race purity and exhorting the Negro masses to return to their ancestral African homeland, a cause which had made Garvey the most controversial black man on earth. Still shouting threats, the Klansmen finally spurred their horses and galloped around the house, shattering every window pane with their gun butts. Then they rode off into the night, their torches flaring, as suddenly as they had come. My father was enraged when he returned. He decided to wait until I was born, which would be soon, and then the family would move. I'm not sure why he made this decision, for he was not a frightened Negro, as most then were, and many still are today. My father was a big 6'4", very black man. He had only one eye. How he'd lost the other one, I have never known. He was from Reynolds, Georgia, where he had left school after the third or maybe fourth grade. He believed, as did Marcus Garvey, that freedom, independence, and self-respect could never be achieved by the Negro in America, and that therefore the Negro should leave America to the white man and return to his African land of origin. Among the reasons my father had decided to risk and dedicate his life to help disseminate this philosophy among his people was that he had seen four of his six brothers die by violence, three of them killed by white men, including one by lynching. What my father could not know then was that of the remaining three, including himself, only one, my Uncle Jim, would die in bed of natural causes. Northern white police were later to shoot my Uncle Oscar, and my father was himself to die by the white man's hands. It has always been my belief that I, too, will die by violence. I have done all that I can to be prepared. I was my father's seventh child. He had three children by a previous marriage, Ella, Earl, and Mary, who lived in Boston. He had met and married my mother in Philadelphia, where their first child, my oldest full brother, Wilfred, was born. They moved from Philadelphia to Omaha, where Hilda and then Philbert were born. I was next in line. My mother was 28 when I was born on May 19, 1925, in an Omaha hospital. Then we moved to Milwaukee, where Reginald was born. From infancy, he had some kind of hernia condition which was to handicap him physically for the rest of his life. Louise Little, my mother, was born in Grenada in the British West Indies, looked like a white woman. Her father was white. She had straight black hair, and her accent did not sound like a Negro's. Of this white father of hers, I know nothing except her shame about it. I remember hearing her say she was glad that she had never seen him. It was, of course, because of him that I got my reddish-brown, marinic color of skin and my hair of the same. Out in the world later on, in Boston and New York, I was among the millions of Negroes who were insane enough to feel that it was some kind of drop of that white rapist's blood that is in me. Our family stayed only briefly in Milwaukee, for my father wanted to find a place where he could raise our own food and perhaps build a business. The teaching of Marcus Garvey stressed becoming independent of the white man. We went next, for some reason, to Lansing, Michigan. My father bought a house, and soon as had been his pattern. He was doing freelance Christian preaching in the local Negro Baptist churches, and during the week he was roaming about spreading word of Marcus Garvey. This time, the get-out-of-town threats came from a local hate society called the Black Legion. They wore black robes instead of white. Soon, nearly everywhere my father went, Black Legionnaires were reviling him as an uppity nigger for wanting to own a store, for living outside the Lansing Negro District, for spreading unrest and dissension among the good niggers. As in Omaha, my mother was pregnant again, this time with my youngest sister. Shortly after Yvonne was born came the Nightmare Night in 1929, my earliest vivid memory. I remember being suddenly snatched awake into a frightening confusion of pistol shots and shouting and smoke and flames. My father had shouted and shot at the two white men who had set the fire and were running away. Our home was burning down around us. We were lunging and bumping and tumbling all over each other trying to escape. My mother, with the baby in her arms, just made it into the yard before the house crashed in, showering sparks. I remember we were outside in the night in our underwear, crying and yelling to clothe and houses temporarily. Then he moved us into another house on the outskirts of East Lansing. In those days, Negroes weren't allowed after dark in East Lansing proper. There's where Michigan State University is located. I related all this January 1963. I told them how East Lansing harassed us so much that we had to move again, this time 2 miles from this home where I started to grow up. After the fire, I remember that my father was called in and questioned about a permit for the pistol with which he had shot at the white man who set the fire. I remember the police were always dropping by our house, shoving things around, just checking or looking for a gun. The pistol they were looking for, which they never found, and for which they wouldn't issue a permit, was sewed up inside a pillow. My father's .22 rifle and his shotgun, though, were right out in the open. Everyone had them for hunting birds and rabbits and other game. After that, my memories are of the friction between my father would beat her. It might have had something to do with the fact that my mother had a pretty good education. Where she got it, I don't know, but an educated woman, I suppose, can't resist the temptation to correct an uneducated man. Every now and then, when she would put those smooth words on him, he would grab her. My father was also belligerent toward all of the children, except me. The older ones he would beat almost savagely if they broke any of his rules, and he had so many rules it was hard to know them all. Nearly all my whippings came from my mother. I actually believe that as anti-white as my father was, he was subconsciously so afflicted with the white man's brainwashing of Negroes that he inclined to favor the light ones, and I was his lightest child. Back when I was growing up, the successful Lansing Negroes were such as waiters and bootblacks. To be a janitor at some downtown store was to be highly respected. The real elite, the big shots, the voices of the race, were the waiters at the Lansing Country Club and the shoeshine boys at the state capitol. The only Negroes who had any money were the ones in the numbers racket, or who ran gambling houses, or who in some other way lived parasitically off the poorest ones, who were the masses. No Negroes were hired then by Lansing's big Oldsmobile plant or the Rio plant. The bulk of the Negroes were either on welfare or WPA, or they starved. The day was to come when our family was so poor that we would eat the whole out of a donut. But at that time, we were much better off than most town Negroes. The reason was, we raised much of our own food out there in the country where we were. We were much better off than the town Negroes who would shout as my father preached for the pie in the sky and the heaven in the hereafter while the white man had his here on earth. I knew that the collections my father got from his preaching were mainly what fed and clothed us, and he also did other odd jobs, but still, the image of him that made me proudest was his crusading and militant campaigning with the word of Marcus Garvey. As young as I was then, I knew from what I overheard that my father was saying something that made him a tough man. I remember an old lady grinning and saying to my father, "You're scaring these white folks to death." One of the reasons I've always felt that my father favored me was that, to the best of my remembrance, it was only me that he sometimes took with him to the Garvey UNIA meetings, which he held quietly in different people's homes. There never were more than a few people at any one time, 20 at most. But that was a lot packed into someone's living room. I noticed how differently they all acted, although sometimes they were the same people who jumped and shouted in church. But in these meetings, both they and my father were more intense, more intelligent, and down to earth. It made me feel the same way. I can remember hearing of Adam driven out of the garden into the caves of Europe, Africa for the Africans, Ethiopians awake. And my father would talk about how it would not be much longer before Africa would be completely run by Negroes. By black men was the phrase he always used. No one knows when the hour of Africa's redemption cometh. It is in the wind. It is coming one day, like a storm. It will be here. I have never understood why, after hearing as much as I did of these kinds of things, I somehow never thought then of the black people in Africa. My image of Africa at the time was of naked savages, cannibals, monkeys and tigers, and steaming jungles. My mother at this time seemed to be always working, cooking, washing, ironing, cleaning, and fussing over us 8 children. And she was usually either arguing with or not speaking to my father. One cause of friction was that she had strong ideas about what she wouldn't eat and didn't want us to eat, including pork and rabbit, both of which my father loved dearly. He was a real Georgia Negro, and he believed in eating plenty of what we in Harlem today call soul food. I've said that my mother was the one who whipped me. At least she did whenever she wasn't ashamed to let the neighbors think that she was killing me. For if she even acted as though she was about to raise her hand to me, I would open my mouth and let the world know about it. If anybody was passing by out on the road, she would either change her mind or just give me a few licks. Thinking about it now, I feel definitely that just as my father favored me for being lighter than the other children, my mother gave me more hell for the same reason. She was very light herself, but she favored the ones who were darker. Wilfred, I know, was particularly her angel. I remember that she would tell me to get out of the house and let the sun shine on you so you can get some color. She went out of her way never to let me become afflicted with a sense of color superiority. I'm sure that she treated me this way partly because of how she came to be light herself. I learned early that crying out in protest could accomplish things. My older brothers and sister had started to school when sometimes they would come in and ask for a buttered biscuit or something, and my mother, impatiently, would tell them no. But I would cry out and make a fuss until I got what I wanted. I remember well how my mother asked me why I couldn't be a nice boy like Wilfred, but I would think to myself that Wilfred, for being so nice and quiet, often stayed hungry. So early in life, I had learned that if you want something, you better make some noise. Not only did we have our big garden, but we raised chickens. My father would buy some baby chicks, and my mother would raise them. We all loved chicken. That was one dish there was no argument with my father about. One thing in particular that I remember made me feel grateful toward my mother was that one day I went and asked her for my own garden. And she did let me have my own little plot. I loved it and took care of it well. I loved especially to grow peas. I was proud when we had them on our table. I would pull out the grass in my garden by hand when the first little blades came up. I would patrol the rows on my hands and knees for any worms and bugs, and I would kill and bury them. And sometimes when I had everything straight and clean for my things to grow, I would lie down on my back between two rows. I would gaze up in the blue sky at the clouds and all kinds of things. At 5, I too began to go to school along with Wilfred. It was the Pleasant Grove School. It was 2 miles outside the city limits, and I guess there was no problem about our attending because we were the only people in the North usually would adopt just a few Negroes in threat. The white kids didn't make any great thing about us either. They called him Darky and Rastus so much that we thought those were our natural names. But they didn't think of it as an insult. It was just the way they thought about us. One afternoon in 1931, when Wilfred Hilda Filbert and I came home, my mother and father were having one of their arguments. There had lately been a lot of tension around the house because of Black Legion threats. Anyway, my father had taken one of the rabbits which we were raising and ordered my mother to cook it. We raised rabbits but sold them to whites. My father had taken a rabbit from the rabbit pen. He had pulled off the rabbit's head. He was so strong, he needed no knife to behead chicken or rabbits. With one twist of his big black hands, he simply twisted off the head and threw the bleeding neck thing back at my mother's feet. My mother was crying. She started to skin the rabbit preparatory to cooking it. But my father was so angry, he slammed on out of the front door and started walking up the road toward town. It was then that my mother had this vision. She had always been a strange woman in this sense and had always had a strong intuition of things about to happen. And most of her children are the same way, I think. When something is about to happen, I can feel something, sense something. I never have known something to happen that has caught me completely off guard, except once. And that was when years later I discovered facts I couldn't believe about a man who, up until that discovery, I would gladly have given my life for. My father was well up the road when my mother ran screaming out to the porch. "Early! Early!" She screamed his name. She clutched her apron up in one hand and ran down across the yard and into the road. My father turned around. He saw her. For some reason, considering how angry he had been when he left, he waved at her. But he kept on going. She told later, my mother, that she had a vision of my father's end. All of the rest of the afternoon, she was not herself, crying and nervous and upset. She finished cooking the rabbit and put the whole thing in the warmer part of the black stove. When my father was not back home by our bedtime, my mother hugged and clutched us, and we felt strange, not knowing what to do because she had never acted like that. I remember waking up to the sound of my mother screaming again. When I scrambled out, I saw the police in the living room. They were trying to calm her down. She had snatched on her clothes to go with them, and all of us children who were staring knew without anyone having to say it that something terrible had happened to our father. My mother was taken by the police to the hospital and to a room where a sheet was over my father in a bed, and she wouldn't look. She was afraid to look. Probably it was wise that she didn't. My father's skull on one side was crushed in, I was told later. Negroes in Lansing have always whispered that he was attacked and then laid across some tracks for a streetcar to run him over. His body was cut almost in half. He lived 2.5 hours in that condition. Negroes then were stronger than they are now, especially Georgia Negroes. Negroes born in Georgia had to be strong simply to survive. It was morning when we children at home got the word that he was dead. I was 6. I can remember a vague commotion. The house filled up with people crying, saying bitterly that the white black legion had finally got him. My mother was hysterical. In the bedroom, women were holding smelling salts under her nose. She was still hysterical at the funeral. I don't have a very clear memory of the funeral either. Oddly, the main thing I remember about it was that it wasn't in a church. And that surprised me, since my father was a preacher, and I had been there when he preached people's funerals in churches. But his was in a funeral home. And I remember that during the service, a big black fly came down and landed on my father's face, and Wilfred sprang up from his chair, and he shooed the fly away, and he came groping back to his chair. There were folding chairs for us to sit on, and the tears were streaming down his face. When we went by the casket, I remember that I thought it looked as if my father's strong black face had been dusted with flour, and I wished they hadn't put on such a lot of it.
The family that Earl Little left behind faced many hardships. When a life insurance policy he had carried refused to pay, claiming the death was a suicide, the family sank quickly into debt and then onto welfare. Louise Little worked whatever jobs she could find, mostly housework and sewing for white families, and Wilfred, the oldest child, quit school and went to work. But there was never enough money, and by 1934, at the height of the Depression, the family was desperate. Growing fast, always hungry, Malcolm would sometimes steal food from stores in Lansing. He also began visiting friends and neighbors around dinner time, particularly a family named Johannes, who were raising a nephew called Big Boy of Malcolm's age. When Malcolm was caught stealing, he became the focus of efforts by state agencies to place Louise Little's children in foster homes. Malcolm's mother made no secret of the hatred she felt for the welfare workers. She deeply resented their frequent visits and became incensed when she discovered that they had already made initial arrangements for Malcolm to live with the Gohanas. The welfare workers began to suggest to the children that their mother might be losing her mind.
It was about this time that a large, dark man from Lansing began visiting. I don't remember how or where he and my mother met. It may have been through some mutual friends. I don't remember what his profession was. In 1935 in Lansing, Negroes didn't have anything you could call a profession. But the man, big and black, looked something like my father. I can remember his name, but there's no need to mention it. He was a single man, and my mother was a widow, only 36 years old. The man was independent. Naturally, she admired that. She was having a hard time disciplining us, and a big man's presence alone would help. And if she had a man to provide, it would send the state people away forever. We all understood without ever saying much about it, or at least we had no objection. We took it in stride, even with some amusement among us, that when the man came, our mother would be all dressed up in the best that she had. She was still a good-looking woman, and she would act differently, lighthearted and laughing, as we hadn't seen her act in years. It went on for about a year, I guess. And then, about 1936 and 1937, the man from Lansing jilted my mother suddenly. He just stopped coming to see her. From what I later understood, he finally backed away from taking on the responsibility of those 8 mouths to feed. He was afraid of so many of us. To this day, I can see the trap that mother was in, saddled with all of us. But it was a terrible shock to her. It was the beginning of the end of reality for my mother. And she began to sit around and walk around talking to herself, almost as though she was unaware that we were there. It became increasingly terrifying. The state people saw her weakening. That was when they began the definiteness, had all said how much they liked me and would like to have me live with them. I liked all of them, too, but I didn't want to leave Wilfred. I looked up to and admired my big brother. I didn't want to leave Hilda, who was like my second mother, or Filbert. Even in our fighting, there was a feeling of brotherly union. Or Reginald, especially, who was weak with his hernia condition and who looked up to me as his big brother who looked out for him as I looked up to Wilfred. And I had nothing either against the babies, Yvonne, Wesley, and Robert. As my mother talked to herself more and more, she gradually became less responsive to us and less responsible. The house became less tidy. We began to be more unkempt, and usually now, Hilda cooked. We children watched our anchor giving way. It was something terrible that you couldn't get your hands on, yet you couldn't get away from. It was a sensing that something bad was going to happen. We younger ones leaned more and more heavily on the relative strength of Wilfred and Hilda, who were the oldest. When finally I was sent to the Gohanas house, at least in a surface way, I was glad. I remember that when I left home with the state, don't let them feed him any pig. It was better in a lot of ways at the Gohanas. Big Boy and I shared his room together, and we hit it off nicely. He just wasn't the same as my blood brothers. The Gohanas were very religious people. Big Boy and I attended church with them. They were sanctified holy rollers now. The preachers and congregations jumped even high and shouted even louder than the Baptists I had known. They sang at the top of their lungs and swayed back and forth and cried and moaned and beat on tambourines and chanted. It was spooky, with ghosts and spirituals and haint seeming to be in the very atmosphere when finally we all came out of the church going back home. Mr. Gahanis was close cronies with some of the other men who had a set rabbit-hunting strategy that they had always used. Usually when a dog jumps a rabbit, and the rabbit passed the very spot where he originally was jumped. Well, the old men would just sit, and I thought of a plan. I would separate from them and Big Boy, and I would go to a priest. It worked like magic. I began to get three and four rabbits before they got one. The astonishing thing was that none of the old men ever figured out why. They outdid themselves, exclaiming what a sure shot I was. I was about 12 then. All I had done was to improve on their strategy, and it was the beginning of a very important lesson in life. That any time you find someone more successful than you are, especially when you're both engaged in the same business, you know they're doing something that you aren't. Suffered a complete breakdown. And the court orders were finally signed. They took her to the state mental hospital at Kalamazoo. It was 70-some miles from Lansing, about an hour and a half on the bus. A Judge McClellan in Lansing had authority over me and all my brothers and sisters. We were state children, court wards. He had the full say-so over 26 years. Later, when I was still growing up in Michigan, I would go to visit her every so often. Nothing that I can imagine could have moved me so deeply as seeing her pitiful state. In 1963, we got my mother out of the hospital, and she now lives there in Lansing with Filbert and his family. It was so much worse than if it had been a physical sickness, for which a cause might have been known, medicine given, a cure effected. Every time I visited her, when finally they led her, a case, a number, back inside from where we had been sitting together, I felt worse. My last visit, when I knew I would never come to see her again, there, was in 1952. I was 27. Visit, she had recognized him somewhat, in spots, he said. But she didn't recognize me at all. She stared at me. She didn't know who I was. Her mind, when I tried to talk, to reach her, was somewhere else. I asked, "Mama, do you know what day it is?" She said, staring, "All the people have gone." I can't describe how I felt. The woman who had brought me into the world and nursed me and advised me and chastised me and loved me didn't know me. It was as if I was trying to walk up the side of a hill of feathers. I looked at her. I listened to her talk. But there was nothing I could do. I truly believe that if ever a state social agency destroyed a family, it destroyed ours. We wanted and tried to stay together. Our home didn't have to be destroyed. But the welfare, the courts, and the doctor gave us the 1-2-3 punch, and ours was not the only case of this kind. I knew I wouldn't be back to see my mother again because it could make me a very vicious and dangerous person. Knowing how they had looked at us as numbers and as a case in their book, not as human beings, and knowing that my mother in there was a statistic that didn't have to be, that existed because of a society's failure, hypocrisy, greed, and lack of mercy and compassion. Hence, I have no mercy or compassion in me for a society that will crush people and then penalize them for not being able to stand up under the weight. I have rarely talked to anyone about my mother, for I believe that I am capable of killing a person without hesitation who happened to make the wrong kind of remark about my mother. So I purposely don't make any opening for some fool to step into. Back when our family was destroyed in 1937, Wilfred and Hilda were old enough so that the state let them stay on their own in the big four-room house that my father had built. Filbert was placed with another family in Lansing, a Mrs. Hackett. while Reginald and Wesley went to live with a family called Williams, who were friends of my mother's, and Yvonne and Robert went to live with a West Indian family named McGuire. Separated though we were, all of us maintained fairly close touch around Lanson, in school and out, whenever we could get together. Despite the artificially created separation and distance between us, we still remained very close in our feelings toward each other. Not long after this, I came into a classroom with my hat on. I did it deliberately. The teacher, who was white, ordered me to keep the hat on and to walk around and around the room until he told me to stop. That way, he said, everyone can see you. Meanwhile, we'll go on with the class for those who are here to learn something. I was still walking around when he got up from his desk and turned to the blackboard to write something on it. Everyone in the classroom was looking when, at this moment, I passed behind his desk, snatched up a thumbtack, and deposited it in his chair. When he turned to sit back down, I was far from the scene of the crime, circling around the rear of the room. Then he hit the tack, and I heard him holler and caught a shock when the decision came that I had been expelled. I guess I must have had some vague idea that if I didn't have to go to school, I'd be allowed to stay on with the Gohannas and wander around town or maybe get a job if I wanted one for pocket money. But I got rocked on my heels when a state man whom I hadn't seen before came and got me at the Gohannas and took me down to court. They told me I was going to reform school. I was still 13 years old.